bit more detail on how to make a conspiracy theory. First of all, you need a good amount of truth. You need some things that are familiar to people. Some things that people know, ah yes, this is true. That's your starting point. You need to introduce a little bit of doubt or uncertainty. Maybe you create a sense of doubt, or you evoke a little bit of doubt or a question that someone's had before. Into that space, you need to introduce something that people want to believe. Something that would be convenient. Something would be easier for them, or maybe something that would make people feel self-important or self-righteous or able to judge others or look at their downfall, a scandal. Or maybe just something that lets people be lazy and carry on with status quo without thinking too much about ethical issues. You need the appearance of credibility. And because most people don't check all the sources, you can just refer to something that sounds credible or is linked to something credible. And once you've got that base there, you can add some blatant fabrication and make a conspiracy theory. So here we go. I thought I'd give an example. Some of you will know a story that came out actually nearly 20 years ago by a man called Dan Brown called The Da Vinci Code. Some conspiracy theories about religions and often part of it about Christianity. So here we go. He starts with some truth. He mentions a person called Jesus who existed. He mentions another person called Da Vinci, who we know was what might be called a polymath. He had excellent abilities in many areas. And the author introduces some interesting maths. So he has well-known facts and interesting facts. Then he introduces some hints. Maybe Jesus didn't die on the cross. Maybe he lived on. And in that, he introduces something that some people would find convenient to believe. Because if Jesus didn't die and then he wasn't raised from the dead, there wasn't a miracle, that doesn't affirm Jesus' life, we don't have to worry about Jesus being God or worshipping him. So he introduces a bit of doubt and something that people would find convenient or easy to believe. Dan Brown then brings in the appearance of credibility by referring to some sources. And one that he refers to is called the Gospel of Thomas. Now, there is a document called the Gospel of Thomas, but it's not actually a gospel. A gospel is a good news story of Jesus' kingdom coming. This document is a collection of sayings. It looks a little bit like this. It was written 100 or 200 years after Jesus, long after his death, not by anyone who knew him closely. It was not accepted by the early church. And as a church historian, I know, has said, it literally has holes in it. The evidence has holes in it, and Dan Brown fills in words conveniently where there are gaps in the manuscript. So from there, the stage is set for the author to create a speedy novel that sounds dramatic and pulls together a story that Jesus didn't die, he married Mary Magdalene, they had children and moved to France, of all places. And in France, they started a secret religious sect where they had secret knowledge and secret practices. Secret knowledge that actually contradicts Jesus' teaching. Secret practices that contradict Jesus' lifestyle. And the whole secrecy and exclusiveness of the sect comprehensively contradicts Jesus' openness and speaking publicly and wanting to invite everyone into the kingdom. So by starting with truth and a little bit of doubt, he spins us around 180 degrees, takes us from a starting point and then goes completely in the opposite direction. So you might be glad to know, we're not planning to create conspiracy theories here. That is not the purpose of saying this. Our passage today is about the truth. And we need a strong counterexample so we can see the patterns. And it is worth you knowing, in the world that we live, and all the different voices that we hear, something of the patterns. And if something is just sounding convenient, or allowing pride or ego or self-satisfaction or laziness to creep in, sometimes that's a warning sign. So, our passage today. We are in Matthew's Gospel. We're looking at the Sermon on the Mount, which parallels the giving of the law by Moses at Mount Sinai. Jesus is talking about a greater righteousness, a righteousness that changes us inside, an internalization of the heart of the law, not just external obedience to rules. And as Jin Ru read out for us, he starts out by saying, referring to two Old Testament laws. The first, the ninth of the Ten Commandments. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbour. And he also refers to a law, if you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay in fulfilling it, for the Lord your God will certainly require it of you, and you will be guilty of sin. But if you refrain from vowing, you will not be guilty of sin. And this and similar laws come up a number of times in the Old Testament. If you make a vow or a promise to the Lord, if you make an oath before the Lord, you are to fulfill it. So Jesus refers to these two Old Testament laws, how we speak of others and how we speak about what we're going to do. And then he carries on and refers to a controversy that was around at his time. Because some of the religious leaders read that law from Deuteronomy, and said, well, if we're not allowed to break a law, a vow, if we make an oath to the Lord, what happens if we make an oath by heaven? I swear by heaven. It has the appearance of credibility, it's referring to God's dwelling place, but is there wriggle room? Is that technically binding, given that I haven't sworn to the Lord? So they started saying, maybe if we swear to heaven, or by earth, or by the temple in Jerusalem, maybe that has the sound of credibility, but there might be some wriggle room to get out. Jesus said, don't do this. Don't do this. Don't create wriggle room. There is no wriggle room. In fact, he takes it further and says, you can't even make an oath by your own head because you don't have power over it. Just live in such a way that when you say yes, it means yes. And when you say no, it means no. You see, the reason humans make oaths is that we all instinctively know that humans are not always trustworthy. People are not always honest. They lie, and sometimes they exaggerate and add to the truth, or cover up and subtract from the truth. People say, it's true, I swear it. That phrase exists because sometimes it might not be true. It's making a point of saying, well, this time I do mean it. Jesus says, don't do this. You don't need to make oaths. If you say yes, let that mean yes. If you say no, let that mean no. Nothing more is required. So how do we live? How do we have a lifestyle that gives credibility to our words? How do we demonstrate the consistency that when we say yes, people know what we mean? If we say no, people know what we mean. How does this link to that first commandment? How do we speak of others? And what is the heart of this law? Because through this section of teaching, every time Jesus draws our attention to the heart of the law, which we are to internalize. We read earlier from Psalm 51. And the psalmist, David, says, you, God, delight in truth in the inward being. Truth is more than skin deep. Truth is not a matter of externals. It's a matter of the transformation of the inward being. So we might say this when people exaggerate. They say the truth, but then go on to add something to make themselves look good, or someone else look bad, or to make their point, or reinforce their agenda. Someone might say, I am not going to that group anymore. They were so rude to me. They were just about nasty. Is that because someone really was intentionally, deliberately rude? If you checked in with them, would that be what they said? Maybe it was because someone said something that cut a little close to home. A home truth that would be easier to avoid. People might say the truth but subtract from it and cover up. Maybe saying something like, oh yes, I informed my colleague of that. But maybe you were also aware that your colleague was busy and not really paying attention and didn't recognise the full consequences of what you were saying, and you didn't follow it up. But by avoiding saying that, the negligence falls on them. People might use technicalities like the scribes tried to, either intentionally or ignorantly, looking at the technical truth rather than deep honesty in the heart. Maybe you've heard someone say or said yourself, I don't see why that person was so annoyed with me. I was just trying to help. I mean, don't they believe in working together? And we focus on that first and prominent intention of trying to help. But going past the technicalities and going a little deeper, maybe we also thought that our way was better, that they weren't doing a very good job, which communicates judgment even if we don't say it. Maybe there's a deeper truth that is being avoided there. Let's look again at our conspiracy theory checklist. Those three examples I've given all have truth in them. They all have a good amount of truth. They all create a little bit of doubt, usually about someone else, maybe about someone else's motives. After all, if you're reporting that someone was rude, other people weren't there, and we never fully know someone else's motives anyway. A little bit of doubt. Maybe we create a little bit of doubt about someone else's diligence or attention or intentions. Maybe we focus on our own goodness and create doubt about the goodwill of another person, saying, well, I was trying to help. Why didn't they want me to do that? All of them have something that is convenient for oneself to believe. One's innocence, one's reason for leaving a difficult person or a situation that challenged you. And all of them have the appearance of credibility, and I think we do this by focusing on the truth part. If we're saying, oh, I was just trying to help, we sincerely focus on our own motives, the best of our own motives. And we do keep a sincere and innocent face, because we're focusing on the good parts of our motives. But maybe if we were to go deeper, it's not all innocent in our motives. The last step for a conspiracy theory is blatant fabrication, and I hope we don't go that far. But some people do. They add or subtract or use technicalities. And as we've seen with that conspiracy theory in Dan Brown's book, the truth can be spun around 180 degrees. If you've never seen that, that's wonderful. But some of you will have seen that. Seen someone in action who can spin the truth around 180 degrees. Truth Jesus calls us to truthfulness in our innermost being. A greater righteousness, not just technical honesty, but internalization of the heart of that law. Honesty and integrity in our innermost parts. So let's look at the two laws that Jesus referred to. The first was in relation to what we say about others. If we want people to believe us, when we say a yes means yes or a no means yes or our testimony is true, wouldn't it be wonderful if we spoke with perfect even-handedness when we spoke of others? In thinking of this, I tried to come up with the word that summed this up best, and I think even-handedness is what came to me. Because we could talk about sincerity, but as I've already said, we can sincerely focus on the good parts of our motives and the bad parts of someone else. If we spoke with even-handedness, with respect about others, the way Jesus would speak of others, how would that be different? And yes, we all need times to speak confidentially about something we're having difficulty with. But even then, this person is created in the image of God. If we spoke with even-handed respect, how would that change our conversation? Maybe you can think of someone else who does this. I can think of some examples. They are people who are so much easier to feel safe around. They convey a deeper trustworthy, not just a literal accuracy, but a deeper trustworthiness when they always speak of others with perfectly level even-handedness and respect. I have a little aside on that point. If you find this hard to do, if you find it hard to speak of someone levelly and respectfully as Jesus might speak of them, I suggest that unforgiveness might be an issue there. I use that as a little warning sign even in my own thoughts. If I'm thinking about someone and I'm finding myself focusing on my good intentions and some aspect of their bad behaviour, and I'm not perhaps being perfectly even-handed in my thoughts, I think, okay, Lord, something more needs to be forgiven here or forgiven again. Jesus said to forgive 70 times 7 or 77 times, doesn't matter which. Keep doing it until those little thoughts don't come up that we can even think of people with even-handedness and respect. The second context we're talking about today is what we say we will do. And again, there's even a hint in the Old Testament law in Deuteronomy that it's better not to make oaths because then you won't fail them. So what if we were really slow and considered in making commitments? If we took our time to think it through, so that when we said yes, it meant yes, and when we said no, it meant no. What would be different? Because again, I think of people who do this. I think of someone in particular who always stops and listens carefully and takes time to consider even a small suggestion. And that person comes across as so much, I feel so much more trustworthy, that person is so much more trustworthy. Because I know that the person has taken me seriously, has thought about what they're saying, and when they say something, I think that's so much more trustworthy. They've taken time over it. The other part in what we say we do is that we are imperfect people and we live in an imperfect world. And if we can't follow through, we need to face up and apologise and say so, because that also increases trust. There is courage and humility and seeking truth in our innermost being. It requires a rigorousness with ourselves, a deep honesty before the Lord. It takes courage and humility, but it has the wonderful news. It frees us from criticism and defensiveness and blaming others and bitterness. It's freeing. And there's good news, three pieces of good news. Firstly, the Holy Spirit is here to help us. We don't do this alone. And noticing the promptings of the Holy Spirit in our thoughts and actions, and coming before the Lord, the Holy Spirit is there to help us to do what otherwise may seem impossible, and I think perhaps actually is impossible without God's help. Second piece of good news is that Jesus' forgiveness is available when we ask. When we do mess it up, we can ask for forgiveness. But I encourage you to be deliberate about that as well. Not merely to have the passing thought, oh well, Jesus will forgive me. We need to stop and ask and acknowledge where we've fallen short, where we've failed, and ask for forgiveness. And in that process, we are able to receive forgiveness for that, and the Lord is able to transform us, transform our inner person. My third piece of good news here, Holy Spirit is able to help. Jesus is able to forgive us when we get it wrong. Is that we get to be part of the good news of God's kingdom in this world. There is so much untrustworthiness and doubt and criticism and hurt in this world. We get to be part of living Jesus' kingdom way. And in doing so, we bring about that by our choice to live with integrity and honesty in our innermost being. I'd like us to take a few moments to pray now.